This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy. Support for Latino USA comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable, all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/latino. That's odoo.com/latino. Odoo, modern management made simple.
Hi, dear listener. It's Maria Hinojosa of Latino USA. And as you may or may not know, because I got a lot of different jobs, y'all, I also co-host another award-winning podcast. It's called In the Thick. It's a show about politics, race, and culture, pretty much unzipped and from a POC perspective. And recently, In the Thick ran an episode talking about the news from Texas and Mexico, all about a woman's right to choose and to make decisions about her own body and what this means about the abortion debate. So we wanted to share this conversation here on the Latino USA feed. And just a warning, there's some explicit language here because, like I said, it's unzipped. So enjoy this episode of In the Thick and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts on.
It's different than in the United States, where activism is so siloed. In Latin American countries, there is a more holistic discussion about what violence against women means.
Uno, dos, tres.
Hey, what's up, fam? Welcome to In the Thick. This is a podcast about politics, race, and culture from a POC perspective. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Jamila King.
Yeah. All right, Jamila King, who's got a new job. Hello.
Hello, hello.
You are now the Deputy Inequality Editor at BuzzFeed News. So congratulations, Jamila.
Thank you so much, Maria.
And thank you for being my co-host today.
Always.
Joining us from Iowa City is Lina Maria Murillo. She's Assistant Professor of Gender, Women's, and Sexuality Studies and History at the University of Iowa. Hey, Lina, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Maria and Jamila. I look forward to this conversation today.
Me too. Thank you for representing Iowa. What? And joining us from Ciudad Juarez, Chihuahua, Mexico, órale, is Veronica Martinez. She's a journalist covering gender and immigration. Bienvenida, Veronica, in the thick.
Hola, Maria. Hola, Jamila. And thank you so much for having me here representing Chihuahua, the Norteñas.
Órale. Before we get to the conversation, folks, remember that, you know, if you hear any dogs, cats, lawnmowers, garbage trucks, sirens, you know, we're respecting the quarantine and recording from home. So it's all women today on the show because we're going to have a conversation about reproductive justice and really what's up with the United States, local, and it begins to feel federal government too, that's just kind of coming after our rights. And that's because of the recent Texas law that went into effect on September 1st, which prohibits abortion once, quote unquote, fetal cardiac activity is detected. That's as early as 6 weeks for most people, actually. Less than a week later, after Texas had made that decision, the Supreme Court of Mexico unanimously ruled that criminalizing abortion is unconstitutional, which is a pretty historic decision. I've got a lot of emotions, like I bet all of you. So we just want to start with doing a temperature check, an element here on In the Thick, when we can just be real about how we're processing it as seres humanos. Lina, vamos a empezar contigo. Like, how are you doing? What is your temperature check?
You know, I was absolutely distraught about the situation in Texas and knowing the work of so many activists and how they have for the last decade, you know, since Rick Perry was in office, have poured so much of their precious time into combating these horrific draconian laws, knowing that they were fighting a ridiculously uphill battle. I mean, that was crushing. You know, some of the activists in El Paso, folks with the West Fund and folks with the latest iteration of Planned Parenthood and other organizations have been doing tons of work, right, in their little corners to provide care for people. And that made me really sad.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, damn, you're just adding another ton for people to carry, just so much more that they have to do in order to continue to provide care, because they're going to continue to provide care. Mm. And then when Mexico came through, I was like,
what?
You know, it was like, yes, Mexico. Like, and we can say all kinds of stuff about the Mexican government, right? There's a lot of problems there for sure. Yeah. When it comes to human rights, when it comes to the rights of journalists and the rights of women. But this was one of those things where it was like, Steven, you know, like you guys see, you guys in the U.S., right? Like we need to have a regional hemispheric approach to thinking about social justice movements. Mm. I did think of it as a human being, but also my scholarly research energy jumped in and I was like, you know, I want to know about what prompted this. You know, for those of us here who aren't constantly keeping up with the news in Mexico, it did seem like not so out of the blue, because there have been, right?
Oh, for yeah. Dude, Las Adelitas.
Yes.
That's all we need to say. Women who took up arms and were fighting in the Mexican Revolution. So this notion, because American mainstream media does not cover mm-hmm. Latin American feminism, period, and certainly not Mexican feminism, but it has been there. And I frankly am proud to say that I'm kind of like a product of that. So hell yes, Latin American feminism has been leading the way. And thank you for that, Lena. And let's check in with you, Veronica. Like, what's your temperature check? ¿Cómo estás? ¿Cómo te estás sintiendo?
Well, for my temperature check, I will say, rather than say that I'm right now like on the red with anger, I feel more green. Right? I feel like it was the decision in the Supreme Court of Mexico that kind of brought this kind of hope that we are going to see some change in our country. Mm. Also, all of this reporting that I did with the series of abortion in a border came in a time where all of the cards were shuffling, right? So right now it's a matter of time and to see what kind of hands we're going to get. Mm. And so in general, as a reporter, I kind of like am feeling the adrenaline, knowing that a lot of mobilization, a lot of marches are going to happen throughout this month. And we already know that also a march is going to happen in El Paso on October 2nd, which, yes. And so in general, as a reporter, I'm ready for it.
Because maybe we all remember that thing called the Women's March, which was like the largest mass mobilization of human beings, I think, ever, maybe. Thank you for that, Veronica, for giving us the sense of, well, people who menstruate and their allies are responding. All right, Jamila, I do want to do a quick temperature check with you. How are you doing?
You know, Maria, I am feeling inspired, actually, you know, going back to what Veronica was saying. Like, I am really inspired to learn outside of a U.S. context. The U.S. context is very boring to me right now. Mm. And I'm feeling inspired to learn more, but I'm also feeling exhausted. And, you know, here we are, what, less than 50 years outside of Roe versus Wade, and we're still having this conversation. So, you know, I'm gearing up for a fight, but I am feeling inspired for what's to come. Mm. And what about you, Maria? What do you feel?
It's been a rough week, you know, as with the 9/11 thing, just like feeling like, how is it possible that in 20 years, yet again, this country feels like it's going backwards? Mm. And why is it that people don't want to wear a mask, but they want to tell me when I have to have an abortion in order to suit their desires, like their timeline? Mm. I'm like very confused and angered. And I think Veronica said, you know, seeing red, like I've been seeing a lot of red of the anger. But I actually love the way you picked it up, Jamila, which is, you know, we're going to choose to be inspired. People are activated and throwing it back to Dolores Huerta, you know, the queen of all organizers and activists, who says, well, whenever there's something that's fucked up that happens, it's always an opportunity for great organizing.
Absolutely.
Okay, Jamila, take it away.
Very, very true. So, Maria, I've been thinking about how what we're seeing in Texas is the result of a white supremacist political minority that's been controlling government for far too long. It didn't just happen overnight. It's the result of Texas Republicans' continued attacks on reproductive health care in that state. In just March 2020, when Governor Abbott signed an executive order to halt all medical procedures deemed not medically necessary under the guise of the pandemic, abortion was one of them.
Damn.
Meaning that Texans have been struggling to find ways to access reproductive health care. But the way this new law is enforced through private citizens is another aspect of the Republican strategy, which is vigilantism. Anna Rubani, co-executive director of Fund Texas Choice, a nonprofit that helps those who travel for abortions, said this on Slate's What's Next podcast on September 7th.
One of the biggest barriers is the waiting period. So there's a mandatory 24-hour waiting period between the sonogram and the procedure, unless you live over 100 miles away from the clinic. And so, you know, the distance, right? Texas is so great in size, but there aren't a lot of clinics everywhere in size. So a lot of our clients have to travel hundreds of miles each way, or they have to leave the state. So our clients in West Texas tend to go to New Mexico because that's closer than going to a clinic in Texas. And then there's a whole nother layer of crisis pregnancy centers that exist who tout themselves as they're going to help you figure it out. And they're going to help you get the care that you need to make the best decision you want to make. But they're anti-choice. They don't have any laws restricting the kind of information they give. And so sometimes they will lie to the client and say, or lie to the patient and say, you're only 4 weeks along or 5 weeks along, even though they're 8 to 10 weeks along. And we've seen clients come to us like 17 weeks along that they thought they were 12 weeks along and had more time to get to the clinic, but they don't. And the other side of it all is there are a limited amount of clinics, and so they get full.
This is the part where, again, because I actually reported about this, y'all, in the Bronx, in the South Bronx, they were doing the same thing. Like they would make it seem like they're Planned Parenthood, but they weren't. And then they would show these horrible videos and basically confuse women and give them misinformation. And already now we're beginning to see like the real impacts, because it is an assault on poor women. Because if you are wealthy, you will get on a plane. But if you don't have money and you don't have documents, you don't have the privilege to be able to travel. And therefore, poor people in the state of Texas, usually Black, Brown, Latinx, Indigenous. So Veronica, I want you to talk a little bit about your reporting. What have you been seeing, like specifically, that you can tell us about?
Yes. And so basically this new law restricts abortions for Texans, right? For people in El Paso, who usually their options were already very limited. So because of the pandemic, Planned Parenthood, it's not performing any abortions. Hilltop Women's Reproductive closed this year. The other option, it's a clinic in Santa Teresa, New Mexico. But that clinic has this expectation of serving the community of El Paso of more than 800,000 people. I want to also kind of like mention how this law also restricts abortion access to people in Juarez permanently. Well, if this law stays in place.
That's interesting. What do you mean?
People from Juarez, I'm talking about privileged people.
Okay.
People who have a tourist visa to cross to El Paso had that option. Well, I can go to El Paso and have an abortion at a safe and legal place in a clinic. But the pandemic with the border closure kind of like closed that opportunity. And so even organizations in Mexico City, they mentioned how they saw a rise in the use of misoprostol.
Oh, I hadn't thought about that.
And that's kind of a medical inducement to provoke a miscarriage. Lena, I'm wondering, because you've written about how historically Texas has been at the center of the battle with Roe v. Wade actually originating in the state. And so I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit more about what's happened now in the context of the history of Texas. Again, we're kind of talking like this white wave of men trying to limit people who menstruate in Texas and can give birth in Texas their access to choice?
Oh, Texas. Texas is such a confounding place. I think part of it has to do with, you know, if we want to go all the way back to the 19th century, I think it has to do with Texas really seeing itself as this outlier, as its own country in some ways. You know, in this case, setting the standard in the most conservative, draconian way with these laws. I was recently talking to a colleague who was saying, oh, well, you know, the mainstream Republican Party is not talking about, you know, this huge coup that they seemingly won in Texas, which is essentially putting a halt to Roe. And I said, you know, the GOP is not homogenous. It is a heterogeneous group of people. And there are some in the party who realize that abortion remains very much a procedure that people across the country understand is necessary, right? Mm. About 60% of the U.S. population still believes in a person's right to choice. But there are some in the Republican Party who are incredibly, increasingly threatened. This is along the lines of also demographic changes, right? To Jamila's point about white supremacy. Mm. Texas is falling in line with states like California, where the electorate is quickly becoming black and brown. Mm. It's not just a coincidence that the law that went into effect restricting abortion is also going into effect at the same time that Texas is instating some of the most ruthless voting rights laws, right? So this is all part of a larger concerted effort to kind of return Texas back to the white Anglo-Saxons who were the settlers back in 1836.
Damn, this sounds so Handmaid's Tale-y.
It really is. I teach that book often in my classes here at the University of Iowa. And there is a section at the end of that book where it's a historian looking back at that Handmaid's record. Mm-hmm. The historian is putting into context Gilead. And he says the reason why Gilead came about is because there was massive demographic decline among the Caucasian race. And the only way for the Caucasian race to reassert itself was essentially to create handmaids to force them to have children, right? Mm. We're assuming that the handmaids that are being forced to have children, unlike the actual show, but in Atwood's novel, these are white women, right? They're being forced to have children. Anti-abortion laws are increasingly becoming critical and central to white supremacist movements in the United States.
Okay, damn.
Who are not only anti-abortion, but anti-contraception, and are wanting to move back to this sort of quote-unquote hashtag trad life, traditional life, where women stay home and rear the children, men are the breadwinners and go out, right? So as Loretta Ross, who's the sort of godmother of reproductive justice, says, you know, like, abortion is the tip of the iceberg.
Wow, thank you for that.
Yeah, but I do want to add that, like, in the context of abortion, we often talk about the legalization, but we don't often frame it about the access. So going back to Juarenses who might have thought about going to the clinics in El Paso to get an abortion, a lot of what the activists in this side of the border were telling me is like, yes, but for us, this law really doesn't make any difference for the women who were already limited to cross the border. Mm-hmm. What happens to that woman who doesn't have a visa? What happens to that woman who doesn't have $400 to $600 to pay for an abortion? Mm-hmm. The same thing goes around for people in Texas who don't have that access. This law also cutting the support system of abortion funds that would have helped women to have access to this medical procedure, it's isolating them. Mm-hmm. So in the concept of accessibility, it was brown people of color, low socioeconomic standard that were, even before this law, not being able to access abortion.
So let's go across the border real quick, because it's a different scenario slightly over there. And we heard historic news from Mexico. Mm. In a case taking place in the border state of Coahuila, the Supreme Court of Mexico ruled that it is unconstitutional to criminalize abortion. We'll talk about cross-border abortion care in a bit, but first we want to debrief this decision. While only four states in Mexico have legalized abortion, this ruling does set a precedent and can now be used to challenge restrictive laws across the country. However, access to abortion care across the country is still difficult due to few clinics offering the procedure, and a 2018 law that gives doctors the right to refuse to perform any procedures that go against their personal beliefs. And doctors and nurses have long reported women who have attempted home abortions. Oh, so
just like, damn.
But this is still a moment of hope. And we are starting to see some abortion restrictions loosen across Latin America, with Argentina's Senate voting last year to legalize abortions up until the 14th week, and Ecuador in April legalizing abortion in cases of rape. Mm. So, Lina, what are your thoughts on the Supreme Court decision, and what impact do you think it'll make?
As I was stating at the top, my reaction initially was of joy. And then I was like, who's responsible for this? And what did they say, right? You know, I went to Veronica's reporting, who's done just incredible work in the border region, and just started to do my own research and make links, and happened upon the president of the Supreme Court in Mexico, Arturo Saldivar's reasoning. You know, what a juxtaposition to the almost emptiness of what the Supreme Court in the United States said when they refused to halt the law in Texas, right? He said, this is about bringing access to care to people across our country. And Veronica, correct me if I'm wrong, but from what I understood, he was saying this is an attempt to reckon with violence against women.
Wow.
It's not just about the decriminalization of abortion, but it's also the attention to violence against women in Mexico.
Wow.
That's the movement, right? It's different than in the United States, where activism is so siloed, right? Like, we're just talking about abortions, right? And there's a group that just does that.
Yeah.
We're talking about, you know, sexual assault and violence, and that's just over here. But in Mexico and in other Latin American countries, there is a more holistic discussion about what violence against women and marginalized people means, right? And so the president of the Supreme Court said, this is what we're going to do. We're going to send attorneys out to places where women and pregnant people are being criminalized for abortion, and we're going to represent them.
Wow.
So this is a shift, right? It's just, again, such a juxtaposition to what not just Texas did, but what the Supreme Court of the United States did, which was to stay silent.
But also the Supreme Court of the United States regarding Roe v. Wade, I want to go back to kind of separating it from the Mexican conversation, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is, let's protect vulnerable people. In the United States, it was like, we care about people's right to privacy. That's what Roe v. Wade is about. And instead, it's become politicized.
Yes.
I don't know. That's deep.
Veronica, what have you heard on the ground there in Mexico?
Okay, so right now, the landscape on the 28 states that still criminalize abortion is that the main obstacle for decriminalizing it, it's the legal code in each state. So right now, Chihuahua, their criminal code still says that any woman who tries to get an abortion and the person that facilitates that procedure can face 6 months to 3 years of jail, right? And so right now, what it's on the hands of the Congress and diputados is to change that criminal code, right? Since I report from Chihuahua, what I've been hearing, what I've been talking with lawyers is about, like, what is Chihuahua going to do the same day that the Supreme Court of Mexico made this decision? A diputada from El PAN, Marisela Terraza Muñoz, supported by the rest of the diputados del PAN, presented an initiative to exhort the Supreme Court to reconsider their decision that they just made in the state of Coahuila. But yeah, like talking with some of the lawyers here in Chihuahua, another one in Mexico City who has worked with GIRE, the Grupo de Información Reproductiva, they're saying how, like, the local Congress has no jurisdiction to change the decision of the Supreme Court, and they know that. And so this is more of a message of, this is the position that Chihuahua, a very conservative state, will have. And then also on September 8th, it was the first day of the administration of our new governor, Maria Eugenia Campos, who has also been very open about her views on abortion and how she supports the El Derecho de la Familia. Only the next day, so September 9, she attended an event here in Ciudad Juarez. Nothing related to abortion, nothing related to health. And she wore a blue handkerchief. And as we know, the green handkerchief represents the pro-abortion movement in Latin America. So in contrast, the blue one represents the pro-life movement.
So let's talk a little bit about these decisions from Texas and the Supreme Court in Mexico, basically happening back to back. And I did, in fact, live through a time when you would go to Mexico to get an abortion, mm-hmm. when abortion was illegal in the United States. Lena, you've written about how this isn't new, that it's been happening for a while. And Veronica, you actually have been reporting for several weeks now, putting together this three-part series for El Paso Matters and La Verdad. It's titled Abortion on the Border. And you spoke with women who traveled across the border on both sides to access reproductive rights, medicine, services. Here's a clip of two women, one who crossed from El Paso, Texas, into Ciudad Juarez, Chihuahua, for the abortion pill, and the other person who went from Juarez to El Paso for an abortion. It's really fascinating. Let's listen.
I think being on the border, it is fortuitous. I think being in Texas is less fortuitous to have the option to cross over to Juarez to get medication is useful. But at the same time, if I was, in another state, maybe I would have had a couple other options and might have felt overall just safer.
Yo reconozco que fue con todos los privilegios. Desde tener el dinero para pagarlo, contar con visa, contar con un carro. O sea, tenía todos los recursos para hacerlo de una manera legal. O sea, no solamente no quieres estar embarazada, todavía tienes que lidiar con todo este rollo legal, económico, emocional. O sea, son tantas cosas. Nada más porque unas cuantas personas que están en el gobierno deciden que no.
I mean, I just remember when I got pregnant twice when I was in college in the early 1980s using birth control. But here's what I did. I went to that student health services at my college, which is a women's college, and I said, I need an abortion. And they said, okay, go here. That was it. So this notion of women having to cross back and forth because al final de cuentas, we will end up getting pregnant sometimes, not all the time. It will happen that we didn't want to be pregnant at that time. Veronica, talk a little bit about what you're seeing in terms of kind of now this conversation about me cruzo, do I cross there? Do I not cross? And of course, in all of the conversation of crossing and going anyplace, we're talking about privilege. You've got a passport, you can cross. But if you don't have, papers, if you don't have the money, you can't do anything.
Yes. And I feel like one of the sources that we spoke with, one of the women who wanted to get an abortion in El Paso, put it very simple. She did it with all of her privilege. And so what we're seeing here in the border is that El Paso, Texas, is no longer a safe, legal haven for them to access abortion. But the conversation for a lot of the activists here still in Mexico, it's about the vulnerable women here in Ciudad Juarez are the ones that don't know the rights. They don't have even 300 pesos to buy misoprostol.
Wow.
That's where the need is. And that's why a lot of the activists, when talking about why are you going out to the streets and marching? Why are you deciding to be an acompañante? Why are you supporting women doing this? A lot of them are saying how, because no one should be doing this alone. No one should have to be navigating this with stigma. They're already going through a very difficult decision. And so this Texas law putting basically a 5-6 week deadline only makes that decision more tough. One of the women that I spoke with, she was only 17 when she had her abortion, but she was saying that she found out that she was pregnant after 3 months because she was still getting her period. It was a very, un sangrado muy leve.
Claro. And she was hoping against all hope that she was not going to be pregnant.
Yeah.
If you see a little bit of blood, you're like, this is great. I'm not pregnant. You know, and it's like, that's how it works.
Yes, yes. Like seeing that, saying it's like, okay, yes, I made it. I'm good.
Exacto.
These men in government are saying no, but this man will never be pregnant. This man will never have to make that decision.
Well, that's what we're talking about. They just don't get it. Like here, because we've had periods and we can talk about, well, you know, if you're spotting and you think this, and men are like, what the hell are you talking about? Like, we don't even know. Like, that's gross. That's this guy. No, that's what our bodies look like. That's what it feels like. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I love what you said about the stigma. That's why I'm so public about having had two abortions, because I don't want any person who has to make this decision. It's hard enough as it is. Mm-hmm. This is not something you're like, oh, great. Let me. No, you don't want it to happen because you don't want to have to be put into this position. Mm-hmm. So I'm just saying I am all about breaking the stigma. Lina, mm-hmm. in your dissertation, you wrote about accessing birth control on the border. So can you talk a little bit about what that access has been like historically and what you're expecting?
Absolutely. I'll do my abbreviated version of my dissertation.
And I know. You're just like, I worked on it for 15 years.
Basically.
Totally. Yeah, I'll give you the 90-second version
real quick.
You know, I'm actually in the process of turning it into a book, tentatively titled Fighting for Control. And it really is about, for so long, Latinas have been kept out of the conversation on reproductive rights, mainly because historians suggested and activists themselves that Latinas and Chicanas were not interested in reproductive rights, but they were busy with issues of, you know, childcare or issues of labor conditions. Or when we think about these other ancillary, supposedly, you know, marginal issues, they are central to reproductive health and they are central and critical to reproductive justice. And so that's kind of the focus of my book. And so I trace the history of Chicanas, Mexicanas in the border region, and how they, you know, first kind of came into connection with organizations like Planned Parenthood in the 1930s, an organization that, you know, is finally kind of attempting to reckon with its very problematic salud.
Cute. Okay. Latinas are just salud anywhere.
I love it.
Manners before anything.
Totally. You know, Planned Parenthood coming to terms with their eugenic history, right? And they did. They engaged in some very problematic birth control campaigns in the border. They went to the border region and they found interested, you know, Anglo residents who wanted to help curb the population of the Mexican community that was increasing, right? This is in the years after the Mexican Revolution. So you have a lot of migration.
Yeah.
It became kind of a main hub for where Mexico and the U.S. could send information about population control, which it was very rarely premised on the ability of people to have reproductive freedom, because wealthy people already had it, you know, as we've been stating, right? This is not new. So this was about teaching poor people how to control and discipline their reproduction, right? And so they went to El Paso, Texas, because it was, you know, the Ellis Island of the Southwest. This is where you had some of the largest, you know, migratory corridors throughout the 20th century. Mm-hmm. In the 1940s and 50s, the role in some ways is reversed. When there are increasing attacks in the U.S. against abortion providers. Now, mind you, this is before Roe v. Wade.
That's what I'm saying.
And even though it was illegal, there were underground abortion providers. And so people could get abortions in the United States. But in the 1940s, after World War II, as men were coming back from war, there was a move by politicians and other moralists of the time that said, no, women need to go back to their more traditional roles. Thank you for helping in the factories while our men were at war, but now you guys have to go back to the kitchen. And so that translated into attacks against underground abortion providers in the U.S. So what did people do? They went to the borderlands. And in places like Juarez in the 1950s and the 1960s, they became kind of the epicenter for abortion provision for people, not only in Juarez, but certainly for American women.
So So let's move on to our final segment, Binge Worthy. We want to know what you're binging on. I will start. I was gifted a collection of poetry by Khalil Gibran, The Prophet, which I'd never read before, and I'm getting into it. I love it. So, Maria, what about you?
Oh, my God. I'm watching two shows, which, of course, feature women. One of them is called Good Girls. I think it is. It's all about women who rob and steal and cheat to make their suburban lives real. And the other one is called The Chair with Sandra Oh, which is all about a woman who is running an English department. Y'all know I work in an English department in my college. So I'm just like, that's what I'm binging on. And I really have enjoyed being disconnected because I've needed it. All right. So what about you, Lena? Something you're binging. It can be poetry. It can be a TV show, a podcast.
I tried to watch The Chair and it was too much like real life. So I had to stop because it was making me crazy. You know what? I have two daughters. They're like in their tween years. And
it's lucky you.
Oh, my goodness. It's a lot. Mm. I watch what they want to watch because we've stuck to the only one TV rule at our house. So they're really obsessed with Grown-ish. And we've been binging Grown-ish for the last, I don't know, like 2 months.
As the country finally saw its blind spot, we were also forced to take notice of our own. The only thing we could do was move forward with our eyes open in an effort to be better people to those around us and hope that the rest of the country would eventually do the same.
And it's just, it's sweet and it's fun. They do have thoughtful conversations about sexuality and race and they have fabulous outfits. And so we just kind of hang out and watch that as a reprieve from all the madness.
All right. Veronica and Ciudad Juarez, what are you binging on?
Well, also considering that this series took me and Victoria more than almost 2 months to report on. Like I was feeling like I was eating, reading, having abortion for breakfast, you know, like all that I was thinking about was that. So also trying to get away from that topic, but also tackling like relevant topics for today. The last show that I completely binged, like it took me less than 2 weeks to end, was Atlanta.
Oh, nice.
Oh, that's a good one.
I was a little bit behind, but also knowing that season 3 is in production, like probably I will binge it again.
Yes.
I feel like Atlanta has a very nice balance of surrealism, but also presenting very real issues.
I had a weird dream. I was swimming in this pool, but it was like the ocean, and I was swimming through seaweed, but it wasn't seaweed. It was just like hands. And I was swimming with this girl, and she was saying if the hands grab you, they pull you down and drown you, so swim above them.
That's deep.
Dude, from Khalil Gibran to Atlanta. I'm just saying, it don't usually happen like that.
We got range.
Mm-hmm. Roll like that right here on In the Thick. Veronica Martinez, journalist covering gender and immigration, and Lena Maria Murillo, assistant professor at the University of Iowa. Thank you so much for joining Jamila and me on this episode of In the Thick. Muchas gracias.
Muchas gracias.
Gracias.
I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Jamila King.
Uno, dos, tres!
And remember, dear listener, go to Apple Podcasts to rate and review us because you know you ain't hearing this conversation anyplace else. Also, remember, you can listen to In the Thick on Pandora, Spotify, wherever you choose to get your podcasts on. Check us out on the web at inthethick.org. Follow us on Twitter and on Instagram at In the Thick Show. And like us on Facebook, please, and tell everybody to listen. In the Thick is produced by Noor Saudi, Harsha Nahata, and our New York Women's Foundation Ignite Fellow, Lisa Salinas, with editorial support from Mike Sargent, Charlotte Mangin, and Nicole Rothwell. Our audio engineering team is Stephanie LeBeau, Julia Caruso, Leah Shaw Dameron, and Gabriela Baez. Our digital editor is Luis Luna. Thanks to Raul Perez for recording me. The music you heard is courtesy of Nacional Captain ZZK Records. We'll see you on our next episode, dear listener. Thanks for listening. Ciao.
Stay safe, y'all. In the border state of Coahuila.
Coahuila.
I almost did it.
We got to get you on your Norteño Mexican states.
I know. Okay. How do you say it?
Coahuila.
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 You got it.
Wow. Okay.
Wow.
Thank you. It's a team effort.
The opinions expressed by the guests and contributors in this podcast are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of Futuro Media or its employees.
Support for Latino USA comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/latino. That's odoo.com/latino. Odoo, modern management made simple.
From PRX.